Hey people, this is the Conspiracy Oz podcast. I'm your host Mick Raven. It is Sunday the 14th of April 2024. This is a review covering alternative news and events. You can call +61 02 8006 1918 anytime. Drop me an email at conspiracyoz@protonmail.com. Go to the website conspiracyoz.com. Download the podcast from iTunes, Spotify or podomatic.com. And get with the D program. Well, it looks like probably next weekend I might not be around for the podcast. Maybe. Depends. I've got to go to the elusive and one of the most fearful events, the dentist. People laugh, but it's not really a laughing matter, is it, people? Everyone out there probably has had that experience, and it's... Yeah, it's funny lying in the dentist chair, and the woman goes, great female dentists, they're the only ones I want to have because they've got the smallest hands and they have great big sausages in your hands, splitting the mouth apart. And she says, oh, what do you do for a living? And I said, oh, I'm a guitar teacher. And straight away she goes, oh, I like to ask people because nobody wants to know about dentists. I said, no, I've done my research. I know all about dentistry, but I don't. But for my particular problem, yes, I needed to research it. Very funny. But nothing to do with me. But I look up, when you look up dentistry and teeth and fake teeth and all these things that people do, I've just got to get a bridge done. So it's not a serious thing, but it's something that's sort of life-changing for someone like me. But then you look up and you see all the people that actually have no real teeth in their head. And you start going, hang on, these are the people I worship. These are the people that you thought were perfect. You know what I mean? You look up and you see people like John Bon Jovi, Clark Gable. And the list goes on. There's this Winston Churchill. That doesn't surprise me at all, actually. But then you've got Emma Watson. I mean, these are like known people. And you think, oh, well, they're doing it because they're known people. But you didn't know it. What about President Joe Biden? and then it goes on. You've got people like Lou Reed. And it's a huge list of people. Egg McMahon. But some of these people are, they're not like hugely famous. But there's people out there you just didn't know. And you start thinking, well, it's not a big deal after all, is it? Then they've got Ben Affleck. Then you've got Florence Henderson. Remember the Brady Bunch's mother? And then she went out with, I think it was Greg Brady, the son in the show. And I think Robert Reed was homosexual. So it was a perfect American family back in the day. And, of course, it was representing the breakup of families, wasn't it, back in the day? Fake teeth as well she had. And then it just goes on. The list, I mean, the lists are huge. You can find them anywhere online. They pulling them all apart, but really it's not, I don't think it's a really big deal. I mean, they're saying that Tom Cruise, and they've got, on it goes, it's Catherine Zeta-Jones, Nicolas Cage, but you sort of expect in a real way that these people have done that. You know, my idol was David Bowie back in the day, and when he was 50, I think he got, all his teeth got veneered, you know, where they shave it away and then they put a cap on it and turn them around straight, something like that. But they say one in five people have got dentures. That's in the world. That's like what? All those fake teeth chattering. So it's not a big deal. But when it personally happens to you, it is. So there's a possibility that next weekend I may not be around simply because of that, but maybe not. I don't know. I've never done this before. Anyway, hopefully it won't affect the voice. that's really what I'm worried about, the main concern. Now, you might have noticed too on the site, just getting back to the real world, that I put up the petition that's on change.org, and it's got the latest headline is cash withdrawals continue to rise. And that's from the petition. I'll just get the name of the petition. The petition is called An Australian Cash and Banking Guarantee. And it's put up, and I just thought this was extremely interesting. You've got to keep your eye on this. Same with the gold. I mean, I'll talk about that later, but it's like, unprecedented what is happening right now. This is not in a few years' time. This is happening right now. We're about to enter the recession now. And you can see the banks are desperate to get control of your money before that happens. They don't want anyone on cash out there being able to support themselves. They need everyone subservient. hooked up to the globalist agenda. And that's to do with the climate hoax and the whole thing. They just want everyone obeying what they say, regardless of what it means or where it goes. They just want you to bow your head and do as you're told. And reading on, it's got, the Reserve Bank of Australia yesterday reported that ATM cash withdrawals continue to rise. It says there were 30,859,700 ATM cash withdrawals made in Australia during February, up by 166,400 withdrawals, which is 0.5% from January, and more than 1 million more withdrawals than 1 year ago in February 2023, up by 3.6%. It says Australians withdrew more than $9.5 billion in total during February 2024, an average withdrawal of $308. 12 months ago, the average ATM withdrawal was $292 in February 2023. It says Australians clearly want access and use cash. It says banks can no longer claim that Australians don't want to access to physical currency as an excuse for closing branches and ATMs. Banks profit from digital payments through merchant service fees and card surcharges, plus the collection of valuable transaction data. Only cash is reliable, private, and surcharge-free. Without cash as a payment option, there is no competitive pressure on the banks to rein in their rising fees. That's so true. Data shows a strong rise in the amount of cash circulating in the community. It says on the 3rd of April 2024, there was over $101.5 billion worth of Australian banknotes on issue, up from $100 billion on the 6th of March 2024. 71% of Australians are worried about a cashless Australia, according to a survey paid for by Wave, a digital payments app. Cash is not disappearing, and the facts are clear. People continue to want cash. So true, people, but this is the reality. The globalists have a finger in all the pies of the major banks international. These banks are tied to those international banks. So that's how the tentacle spreads. All the major corporations in Australia are tied to the major banks, which are then tied to those international banks, which again are again tied to major shareholders, globalists. So this and their families. So this is the problem. There will be done. That's the that's the possibility of a new world order, because it's not some pipe dream ideology thought up by Mao Zedong or Joseph Stalin. This is an idea that all of these globalists agree on, to control the rest of the planet and all its inhabitants from this day forward with their own rules and goals. Okay, you don't get a say. It's not democratic. This is something people don't get, especially all the minions that keep falling for it over and over again. So the end game will be that you have no freedom, no choice. You are surveyed from birth to death, medicated how they'd like to medicate you. And if you step out of line, you may end up in the Soylent Green bin. Who knows? But this must stop. This cannot happen, okay? You want a free society? There's nothing free about this society, okay? It's almost exactly a replica, a blueprint or a red print of the Chinese Communist Party and what they want. They work on top of the whole structure like a capitalist system. They're some of the richest billionaires in the world are actually Chinese nationals, okay? And they rein them in and take their money off them down the track, because that's the ideology. You can't prosper. You have to share. But at the same time, you can see that China is on the take. So what's the difference? There is none. The people at the top are exactly the same as the globalists. They want the same thing, complete control. It's got nothing to do with nationalism, nothing to do with religion, because there's no religion in communist China anymore. It's got nothing to do with any of the old school ways of doing society. It's a brand new world, as opposed to a brave new world, but same thing. And actually an update from the change.org petition, which is incidentally, I'm just going to see how many people are on it again, because I haven't looked at it for that reason yet, but 175,000 people have signed it. It keeps going up as I look at it. But then if you go back to the latest stories, which I was just about to read, you'll see that the Commonwealth Bank, which is a globalist shill for the New World Order has now said on the 11th of April 2024, cash payments over $500 should be banned. That's the Commonwealth Bank boss, Matt Common, saying. He's saying any cash payments over $500 should be done through the electronic payment system, said Common. Common. This would likely save the government $5 billion in tax revenue leaks. I mean, these are the people that make money when you use a card, like just to do a transaction. It says, also last week, Matt Common admitted that the banks helped create the cash crisis in Australia by underpaying the armoured truck companies for many years. Actually, I've got to click on that link and see why he would actually confess to that. But I'll just go to the article. It looks like it's a subscription only. It's from The Australian. And it's I'll just read the headline they've left me with, because otherwise you've got to sign up for Rupert Murdoch to get some money off you. They're all fleecing it, people, even the information. Prestigeute Media. It says, Commonwealth Bank of Australia boss calls for radical tax overhaul. CBA boss Matt Common has issued a bold call for sweeping tax reforms to revive Australia's flagging economic prospects. So let's go and see where he actually said that there was a problem with Armaguard underpaying them. One sec. Now, it wasn't actually Armaguard. Now I reread it, the actual petition. It actually says armored trucks. So they're saying the banks helped create the cash crisis in Australia by underpaying the armoured truck companies for many years. Now, I think that refers to the big fine they just recently copped. This is a few years back. I'll see if I can find it. It's this particular article is from 2018, November 2018. From the Sydney Morning Herald, smh.com.au. It says, Commonwealth Bank of Australia admits to putting profits over customers in historic grilling. And it says, Commonwealth Bank Chief Executive Matt Common has admitted to a broken culture at the bank that saw it repeatedly prioritise profits over the interests of its customers, including the charging of inflated mortgage broking commissions and unjustified fees in the sale of dud insurance to tens of thousands of customers. So there's your first one, Matt. And then I'll find the other one that just came out about the fines, the big fines. So this is from crikey.com.au. It says, I love the headline, wage theft isn't complex, just ask the Commonwealth Bank. It came out on February the 16th, 2024. It says, reckon wage theft is because awards are too complex? Not at the Commonwealth Bank, which just copped a record fine for underpaying its staff. So they obviously mean everyone attached to the banking system. This is what I'm thinking about the armored trucks. Everyone's attached to the banking system for the Commonwealth Bank has been hurt by the underpaying, but also the fact that they're closing branches, getting rid of ATMs and forcing their own workforce onto the streets, just simply because it's a mandate to get us to cancel cash. So if they get rid of cash, they get rid of the armored truck businesses, they get rid of most of the bricks and mortar. They don't need them because you can do it all online. So it's obvious that these major shareholders, and I did look up the Commonwealth Bank and Vanguard, an American corporation fund master, is the leading major shareholder of the Commonwealth Bank in Australia. So there you go. A globalist institution, one of the big 10, has got its fingers in the pie of an Australian bank. So it makes you wonder if the word Australian even means anything at all. Now, reading on from that article, it says, the Commonwealth Bank's management might have been happy with its $5 billion profit announcement this week, but yesterday the federal court dished up an ugly footnote. The bank copped a record $10.34 million fine for wage theft by the CBA and ComSec, which underpaid staff by $16 million over a period of years. Yet they only got fined $10 million and they fleeced $16 million. How does that equal? It says, now credit where due. I like that bit. The reason it was a record fine is because of the changes to wage theft laws by the Turnbull government, which made it easier to prosecute and increase fines for serious contraventions. It says, and these were serious contraventions. It says, the persisting line from big business is that wage theft is because of awkward complexity. If only we could strip away many of those conditions and protections for workers, wage underpayment would be heavily reduced among hard-pressed employers. It's a particularly favoured line of the Business Council of Australia, of which the Commonwealth Bank is a member. It says, whilst the Commonwealth Bank's underpayment of 7,400 CBA and ComSec employees from 2015 to 2021 a case of awkward complexity, not according to the Federal Court Judge Robert Bromwich, who found that senior staff at the CBA and ComSec had put on notice of potential non-compliance issues and knew facts that should have sounded a warning, but took years to address the non-compliance issues. He also found that responsible HR managers had disregarded or been indifferent to the risk that individual flexibility arrangements were not meeting the employees' entitlements. Oh, they're fleecing them, people. This is one of Australia's biggest companies. I see it's a company, people. With a huge HR department operating in financial services. It was altered to the underpayments and did nothing. According to Bromwich, CBA managers were amply able to prevent anything of this nature occurring in the first place, let alone over such a substantial period of time. It's on purpose. The obligations were readily able to be complied with and proper checks to ensure that was taking place was not hard to implement. That did not happen. Anyway, this guy also wants to overhaul the tax system too, people. He wants to, listen to this. He wants everyone that earns under $20,000 to not pay tax. And he wants the same people to not get a tax, what do they call it? Like a tax cut. But well, they're not paying tax. But he wants others after that to start paying more. And wait for it, the GST up to 15%. That's going to work, isn't it, people? Oh, these people in the ivory towers. And on the footnote too of that, just back in November 2023, this is before it looked like Armaguard were definitely going under, this is when the big banks, including the CBA, all came forward to try and help Armaguard, the very company they were destroying through underpayments and closing bank branches, lending a hand, a bit of a handout from the globalists. You can see straight away the conditions would be flying left, right and centre. But this article says, and this is from the Australian Financial Review, came out on November the 30th, 2023. It says, banks call for crisis talks as cash transport firm teeters. Says Lindsay Fox-owned cash transport firm Armaguard is seeking an injection of funding to ensure it can operate its banknote distribution services profitably. Just 5 months after it merged with rival Prosegur to create a near monopoly that was supposed to prop up the industry. Banks filed an urgent application to the competition regulator on Wednesday to allow them to meet and discuss a joint response to the possible distributing cash around the nation. It says, as the banks push customers towards digital payments and cash use declines, Armaguard is making heavy losses. The percentage of payments in cash has plunged from 62% in 2010 to 13% in 2021. Well, the pandemic helped that. It's very easy to see that you could say 13% by 2021 when no one was allowed out. So that's a furphy already. But anyway, and it's expected to continue to fall. So you can see straight away they're using 2021 when it's actually 2023. When the article came out, it says this has jacked up the unit cost of delivering banknotes to bank branches, which are closing, and retailers in fleets of trucks. The decline in cash payments has come despite the value of banknotes in circulation hitting records last year. Funny that. As people stuff it under their mattresses for emergencies such as natural disasters and, wait for it, people, telecommunication outages. It's so true, isn't it? And reading on, it's got the banks want the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission decision on waiving competition laws to allow the talks by the end of next week, reflecting the urgency of the situation. It says last month, Armaguard advised banks that the challenge of rapidly declining cash use now has put the continued viability of their business at risk, the Australian Banking Association said on Wednesday. Jim Chalmers, told the Australian Financial Review the federal government is working closely with Australian banks, the RBA and the industry to ensure the Australians continue to access cash. The exact opposite is happening. They're letting the banks close all the branches, get rid of the ATMs, and then say that people aren't using them because they can't get hold of them. It says the merger between Armaguard and Spain's Prosegur, approved by the ACCC despite creating a company with 90% share of the cash distribution market, they must have knew it was going to fail, people, was supposed to relieve financial pressure on Armaguard by allowing it to consolidate truck routes and cash distribution centres. But the merged company is still operating at a steep loss, with projections pointing to $190 million cash deficit over the next 3 years. It's got Armaguard's request for industry support was made at a meeting initiated by the Reserve Bank Governor Michelle Bullock, what a name, on October the 30th. Armaguard told the representatives from the major banks, along with the officials from the Treasury and the RBA, that it had insufficient self-generating funds to reinvest in the future sustainability of its distribution network. It's allowed to fail, people. The private company owned by billionaire trucking magnate Mr. Fox also expressed concerns about the ongoing viability of its business model. Notwithstanding the merger, and indicated there was a real risk that it would cease to supply services in the short term without further financial support, according to people at the meeting. Now, that's what's just happened, people. The banks came in, they all offered their globalist arm, and I think Lindsay Fox did, I wouldn't say he did the finger, but he just said, we'll look after it ourselves, which means it's probably going to go under. And it says here, Armaguard asked for an extra $190 million cash injection over 3 years to ensure it could operate profitably over that period. ABA staff were in Canberra on Tuesday and Wednesday to brief politicians on the situation. Access to cash remains a key pillar of the government's payments policy, and the banks said they wanted to back a sustainable model. Don't you love that word? I mean, banks, money's made out of plastic. Sustainable model. To ensure cash continue to circulate for those who wish to use it, which is over a million transactions a day. I think there's a lot of people that want to use it. The challenge facing our economy and society is that the use of cash for payments declines. The unit cost of transporting and distributing it escalates. The ABA chief executive, Anna Bligh, remember that? The Premier of Queensland is now a big banking mogul. She said, the reason the ABA is seeking authorization from the ACCC is so banks can be part of the solution to design a, here we go, sustainable model, plastic notes, for people to access cash in the long-term future. The ACCC provides authorization for the banks to collectively negotiate with Armaguard. Well, they never didn't happen, people. Their meetings are likely to discuss not only the short-term issue of extra financial support for Armaguard, but longer-term solutions for the troubled industry. Well, that didn't happen. Remember, this was back in 23 when this article came out. I won't read the rest of it. You can see straight away it was leading up to a bigger problem, which is the fact that the banks keep closing the branches and the ATMs and restricting it, making it harder and harder to use cash. That's the mandate, people. And actually, I'll put this last paragraph in, which was attached to that story, which I thought was really important. It says banks have been undergoing political pressure this year after the committee heard evidence that cash banking is an essential service for many members of the community, particularly the vulnerable and the marginalised who lack digital skills and financial literacy, creating a new political pressure point for the banks. Now, that's interesting because if the government does nothing about it, the voters who are older and are fed up with this system will not vote for them. They will vote for someone else that does want to keep cash. So it's going to be very interesting how the political situation plays out on this particular subject. And to finish up, this is another link I found online, but it leads back to this petition to save cash. It says, it's called Banks Must Fix the Cash Crisis They Created, 27th of March, 2024. It says, and it's from a site called prwire.com.au. It says, banks created the cash crisis, they must pay to fix it. Banks are reportedly only offering Armaguard a short-term solution to the cash crisis they created. The decline in the numbers of bank-owned ATMs and bank branches far outstrips the decline in cash usage. Says the big banks are failing to find a viable long-term solution to the cash crisis they created, said Jason Bryce, spokesperson for the Cash Welcome Campaign. So it's the Cash Welcome Campaign that's speaking. And it says, the data proves the big banks are herding Australians towards a cashless society against their will. Why haven't the big banks planned ahead and come up with a plan for distributing cash? Well, because they want a cashless society. It says, why have the big banks allowed this situation to develop? Asked Jason Bryce, for the same reason I just said. The total number of ATM cash withdrawals rose by almost 500,000 transactions in January 2024 to 3.2 million from the 29.76 million in December. The number of bank-owned ATMs has fallen more than 40% since June 2020. I've read this before, I know. And it's got Commonwealth Bank is redirecting bank customers to computer terminals, says the Finance Sector Union. The CBA claims branches are shutting because of the reduction in over-the-counter transactions, but the reality is they are forcing staff to move customers to digital banking by directing them to computer terminals in the branch. Now, that's very interesting. ANZ's bank, I remember going to the motor registry. It's not called that now. It's called Service New South Wales. You go in there and you expect someone behind the counter to help you fill out the form. But what they do is direct you to a computer terminal and tell you to fill it out and do it yourself. And then you talk to the person. You find out they're just a substitute person. They may not even live in New South Wales. They're there on the day just to do what I just said. And you go, what? And that's government for you. It says ANZ Bank's secret cashless agenda was exposed by the whistleblower in November. So that's the ANZ. Bankwest said customers prefer digital when they announced the closure of all branches. Westpac repeated the gaslighting while announcing the closure of branches in New South Victoria. These are all globalist major shareholders that sit on the boards of these particular banks. It's really criminal, people, what is happening, and no one gets it. Reading on, it says Westpac repeated the gaslighting while announcing the closure of branches in New South Wales and Victoria. NAB also pointed at customers as a reason for bank closures. It says banks profit from fees and data produced by card and phone purchases, so they are making it harder for us to use cash, says Jason Bryce. Australians are withdrawing about the same amount of cash from fewer ATMs and fewer bank branches. Banks created the crisis themselves, and now the banks need to pay to fix it. Banks have made millions of dollars over the last few years by limiting our access to cash. Banks need to pay to ensure we can access our cash when we want it. This is so true. So go and sign the form, people. Left side of the widget bar on conspiracyhouse.com. An Australian banking and cash guarantee. Sign it, people, like I have. It's a worthy cause to be able to have a bit of privacy when you buy something. And actually, to finish off the whole thing, and this is from the actual change.org petition, reading on, it says, there were two cash-in-transit companies in Australia called Armaguard and Prosegur. I think that's how you say it now, the Spanish company. Until recently, the banks made them compete hard for the business of transporting cash. Now there is only one company and it's in trouble. The cash distribution model effectively had a very aggressive price-based competition over many years. And then it says, what we did, and this is Matt Common from the Commonwealth Bank Australia, said what we did was, we and others, accepted very attractive commercial terms. Perhaps we should have had the foresight, really, to think, well, that actually looks like an unsustainable pricing and commercial model. They knew that it was unsustainable and not a commercial model. They knew. That's why they let it fail, people. And then reading on the rest of the article from the change.org petition, our big banks sit at the heart of the financial system. Every Australian needs a bank account to be paid. Only the big four banks have agreements to buy physical banknotes from the Reserve Bank of Australia. The banks need to provide us with access to our physical money in our local communities and guarantee that cash will always be available when we want it. Only cash is private, reliable, and surcharge free. There you go, people. I mean, that really, that really says it all. And the latest update on Armour Guard 2, by the way, people, because I just did a search on it, everything is you've got to pay subscription to get the full story, but just the three lines alone says it all. Lynn Fox Executive Chairman Peter Fox says the billionaire family will keep Armour Guard in business for at least 3 years, but only if the banks and the major retailers agree to pay more for its monopoly cash transit services. So each one holding the other one to ransom people. And in the end, who pays more? Well, the taxpayers, don't they? Because you keep wanting to use cash, don't you? And that article was from the 4th of April 2024, AFR.com, the Australian Financial Review. And the earlier article too that said that they rejected the bank's bailout. This was from March 28, 2024, and it was from sydneymorningherald.com.au. Armour Guard rejects $26 million lifeline after being asked to open its books. It's got the nation's key cash transit business. Armour Guard has snubbed the $26 million lifeline for Australia's biggest banks and retailers and will receive a $10 million cash injection from its parent company, Lynn Fox, instead, keeping the company afloat over the coming weeks. It says, in a consortium led by the Australian Banking Association, the Commonwealth Bank, NAB, Westpac, ANZ, Coles, Woolworths, Wesfarmers and Australia Post, last Tuesday put the $26 million offer to Armour Guard with a deadline to respond by 3 p.m. Thursday and subject to what they considered reasonable conditions. However, a source close to the negotiations, but not authorised to speak, publicly said the conditions put on the deal were unworkable and too restrictive for Armour Guard. So there's the globalist arm people. And the company would seek funding support from customers individually, which hence the extra costs. Armour Guard can confirm it is working constructively with all its customers, including its retail customers, banks and other key stakeholders regarding both short-term and long-term financial solutions for the industry to remain sustainable. It's funny because the very ones they're talking about are the very ones that offered them the the bailout. So Armour Guard continues to operate its full suite of services and is confident over the coming months, not years, it will get the business onto long-term sustainable footing with appropriate support from the industry. So it sounds like they're just going to get bled of cash, literally, to save cash. And that's definitely a globalist thing because it means it's all imploding itself. And they don't really have to even bother with it. Just keep closing the bank branches and making the ATMs more restrictive. That's all they have to do. If you can't transport cash and you can't get cash, cash is dead. That's it. Now, on the same thing as cash is dead, gold is actually going through the roof, people. I'm just going to go to the site now and just check where gold's at on the 14th of April 2024, this Sunday. And it's got here, and it looks like it's only going up to the 13th. They don't want to show today's people, but yesterday's one. If I can just get that to, actually it's doing it. I think it's going to do today's. No, it's not. It's still on the 13th. So it hasn't, probably because the day's trading isn't over, but still. The close of yesterday's was $2,357 an ounce, and that's Australian dollars. That's unprecedented. I'm going to say it because it is. I mean, you can look at a 20-year history if you click on that widget on the right-hand side of the widget bar of conspiracyoz.com, and you'll see at ABC Bullion that that's the highest it's ever been. And if you look at the graph properly, you can see that it's going vertical for most of this year. It's just going straight up. There's no down. It's up all the way. It's not going to come down anymore now. So I don't know what else you need as an indicator. If there are people out there that are in the know buying gold because they know something's coming, and the bankruptcies, and I'll go and have a look at them right now too, are also going through the roof. Something's dreadfully wrong, people. These are indicators. No crystal ball involved. They're still saying the same. They've got February at nearly 1,000 companies going bust, big companies. And then if you look at March, it says 595. It's complete furphy. They will fix that. Come the end of April and it starts in May, they'll fix the March one. It'll be straight up to 900 or 1,000. It's not going down now. This is it. We are at the beginning of the recession, world recession, and it's not going to come back from it. So I just thought I'd, you know, I mean, these are all, you can do with it what you will, you know, believe it or not, whatever you want to do. It's all speculation, but at the same time, there are very strong indicators that if you look back at the global financial crisis in 2008, 2009, you'll see the same indicators spiked. So it's a little bit of an indication. And remember, the globals planned this. So they have a foresight into what's going on. So that's another thing that you've got to watch, is that they let each other know what they're up to, and you see it in the markets. But they don't tell you. They're not going to tell you in black and white that they would like to take your job, your car and your home off you and throw you on the street ready for the mass cult. They're just not going to do that, people. They'll just keep talking the talk, as the press tube media does. I mean, today we had all the news worldwide was about the Bondi Junction shootings, where I think it's 6 people died, 11 in hospital, a mother and a baby, all this sort of stuff, by a lone nutcase with a knife. And you think, okay, this 40-year-old is actually from Queensland, came down to New South Wales, which is really odd already, started living out of his car, and you start thinking, why? And next minute he's on a murderous rampage and then shot dead by a female police officer. So you can't type the loose end. You'll never know. See, when they psyop something, whether it's a nut or not, they use nuts to do this for a means to an end. So straight away, the first thing I thought, which is what you think when you hear a prostitute media headline, because they sort of walk you down that path. But in this case, I went on a different path because I saw, a lot of people don't know, in Bondi Junction, it's a very, very, probably the biggest Jewish community in Australia. So obviously, because of the war in Israel, with Iran now launching drone strikes into Israel, this is the war spreading worldwide. Of course, they said the guy with the knife was not a terrorist. He acted as a lone wolf. He's a nutcase. And he's dead. And they close the door. But me, no. I want to know, okay, who got killed? Was it an actual targeted attack? I heard the mention of John Singleton in there, who's a prominent Australian businessman. Actually, I'll go and check the headlines just for that. I didn't want to get caught up in this because I know everyone must be sick of it. The people involved, the police, they must be absolutely sick of this. But it does prove one thing. There's not enough police on the beat anymore. Okay, not that I want a police state. I don't. But at the same time, that's what they're paid to do. Stop the nuts before they go crazy. The main road where I live, 2 o'clock in the morning, police straight up the road, their sirens blaring, no one on the road. And then you hear about this, where there's only one solitary female police officer to stop a crazy person. You know? Anyway, let me just see if there's any more updates on the victims, that the deceased victims of this crazy person. And that's what it is. Okay, here's the headline. It says, if I can get this up properly, daughter of entrepreneur John Singleton named as Bondi Junction victim, 14th of April, 2024. And it says, Dawn Singleton, the daughter of one of Australia's best-known businessmen, John Singo. Singleton has been identified as among those killed in the Bondi Junction stabbing attack. Now, obviously not Jewish. Singleton, 25, was one of 3 daughters from the marriage between John and his sixth wife, lawyer Julie Martin. The couple have since divorced. It says, after attending Kambala Girls' School at Rose Bay, from preparation onwards, Dawn completed the Bachelor of Communications, Digital and Social Media at the University of Technology, Sydney. She had been working as an e-commerce assistant at the White Fox Boutique fashion business. 5 women and 1 man were killed in Saturday's attack, in which 40-year-old Joel Couchy stabbed victims at the Westfield Shopping Centre at Bondi Junction. Couchy was shot dead by a police officer at the scene. John Singleton, 82, built his fortune in publishing, advertising and racing to become one of Australia's most successful businessmen. He had 8 children. The principal at Kambala School, Jane Danvers, paid tribute to Dawn Singleton as a valued former student in a message to parents. So he was. This is a big guy. You start thinking, hang on, is this targeted? And then you don't know. Remember when John Lennon was killed, that fellow that shot John Lennon dead, way back in 1980, that fellow had psychiatric problems from when he was a child, and he was mentored. Now, this is a really important thing to understand, people. Some of these institutions, and I'm not saying FBI, CIA, but some of these well-known sort of institutions in the US have been known to take under their wing these types of personalities because they can use them as assets later. No one can prove it because it's a secret sort of situation. But let me just let's see if it's the cat's out of the bag. Let's see if they say about, I think it's John Chapman, John Lennon's killer. Let's see if the cat's been out of the bag since that killing, which was almost 44 years ago. One sec. Just like to correct that. It's actually Mark John Chapman. And why do you hear this? This is something recent that happened roughly about 12 months ago. So this is another smoking gun, another rabbit hole. I'm not going to go down today, but I'll just mention in reference to this guy who killed the six people and another 11 or so are in hospital in Bondi Junction yesterday, had had psychiatric problems since he was 17. And the police knew of him because of his mental condition. So that's interesting too. But still, this is much bigger, but the John Lennon thing, I can tell you. Not to put anything on the people that have been killed in Bondi, but to say internationally, the killing of John Lennon was a very big deal. And it says here, and this is interesting. I didn't know about this either, people. I just found it and trying to let you know that there are powers that be that use these people as what's called as patsies. That's what they call them. So here it says in this title, this is from the NewYorkPost.com. It says, second gunman, not Mark David Chapman, may have shot John Lennon, author claims. And you're going, oh, here we go. Can of worms, yes, people. April the 22nd, 2023. It says, Mark David Chapman might be innocent in the murder of John Lennon, according to British author and TV producer who said his upcoming documentary and book outline how a second shooter might have killed the iconic singer. Now, remember when John F. Kennedy got shot, they used another patsy to kill Lennon and then claim that that John F. Kennedy was shot from a different area and from a different angle. It's the same thing they're saying here. It's exactly the same thing. So you got to think to yourself, well, hang on, is this a common thing they do? Well, it actually is. They train people up that'll be slightly psychotic or psychiatric problems. They get them to be a patsy, to be somewhere at a certain time, and more or less put the gun in their hand. But they make sure that when they kill someone, that they're killed properly, clinically, just like John F. Kennedy was. Even the Port Arthur shootings with Martin Bryant in Tasmania in 1996, I think it was, even the killings there were clinical and professional. And the guy had something like an IQ of 60 and like a 12-year-old, and he couldn't shoot at all. Apparently, so you start to wonder, hang on. And when they saw the shooter on the day in Port Arthur, he was wearing like a mask. But because he had the tuft of blonde hair at the back, well, it must be him. Same thing. This is a common thing they do because they need a fall guy. They need someone to take the rap. But then they get the job done. You know, guns were banned in Australia in 1996. John F. Kennedy was killed and replaced by Lyndon B. Johnson to do with Vietnam War and the Mafia. Can of worms everywhere. I'm not going to get into it, but you can see that it has been happening for a long time. So when I read this about John Lennon, I had to think twice because I didn't know about this, people. I knew that Chapman had problems and he'd been trained in the military from psychiatric sort of professionals. I knew that, but and it says it here, so I'll read it. But anyway, but I didn't know about a second shooter. That's really, really interesting. So it says, Chapman may have been brainwashed by the CIA to serve as a patsy, according to David Whelan, who spent 3 years investigating what he called astonishing inconsistencies in the official narrative of John Lennon's 1980 slaying, as well as weird coincidences. It's the same with Martin Bryant. As soon as the killing started in Port Arthur, the police were called away to a dummy sort of incident. That's why they reckon they couldn't get to him. But anyway, that's another story too. I don't want to get into that. So it says, Whelan, whose book, Gimme Some Truth, The Assassination of John Lennon, and a documentary will be released later this year. So this is probably 6 months ago now that it should have been released. So maybe it has. I don't know. I'm just reading this 12-month-old story. And it said, told the Post he believes the official narrative that Lennon was shot from behind by Chapman is untrue, and that a more professionally trained gunman shot him from the front into his chest. It says, as part of his research, Whelan spoke to the surgeon, Dr. David Halloran, and two nurses, Barbara Camara and Dia Sato, who tried to save the dying Lenin as the former Roosevelt Hospital and to lead detective who handled the case. It says, he has also pulled through reams of police and medical records, he said in an interview from his London home Saturday. It says, Lenin was fatally shot on the December 8th, 1980, as he and his wife, Yoko Ono, were returning to their apartment at the Dakota on Central Park West. Chapman, now 67, described as an obsessed fan with mental problems, shot the former Beatle with a .38 revolver. He pleaded guilty to the murder after his lawyers briefly considered an insanity defense and is serving 20 years to life sentence at the Greenhaven Correctional Facility in upstate New York. He's been denied parole at least 12 times. So he's been in jail 44 years, people. Whelan said the official narrative says Lenin was shot from behind, but his interviews and research with the surgeon and nurses, among others, indicated that Lenin was shot from by someone in front of him. In addition, Whelan said it was dark that night and Chapman was reportedly about 25 feet from Lenin when he fired, a vast distance for an untrained marksman. Yet the bullets entered Lenin in a closed grouping that looked professional, Whelan said. It says Dr. Halloran said that not even a Navy SEAL could pull it off from that distance, Whelan said. Whelan said he discovered that Chapman had a long history of associating with charismatic Southern Christian preachers who had ties to former President Richard Nixon, as well as to psychiatrists with links to military intelligence. It's on record that four psychiatrists known for their forensic psychiatry and skill in hypnosis, including one expert in the CIA's notorious mind control program, MK Ultra, visited Chapman's prison cell within a month of his arrest for Lenin's murder. Among them was former CIA consultant Milton Klein, a New York psychologist and expert hypnotist who once said he could create a patsy in 3 months, but it would take 6 months to make someone an assassin. They do this, people. It's got Bernard Diamond, a renowned forensic psychiatrist and expert hypnotist who has a witness for the who was a witness for the defense of the trial of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., assassin Siran Siran, and who hypnotized Siran while he was in his cell, successfully instructing him to climb like a monkey, also visited Chapman in jail. Whelan said he believes Chapman may have been groomed and mind controlled to be the front man so that Lenin could be taken out by a professional assassin. Because at the time, Lenin was doing big protest, like the anti-Vietnam. At the time, that wouldn't have been the Vietnam, but he was organizing more protests. So he hadn't given up his protest banner just yet, and they were sort of getting sick of him. The CIA and the FBI were sort of onto it. So everyone pointed the finger at them, but they thought, well, the crazy did it. That's what people do, then they close the book. But see, when you do your investigation, you say, well, hang on, the evidence doesn't support the narrative, so there's inconsistencies, and that's what makes people dig. So it says David Wedge, who co-authored, the 2020s, The Days of John Lennon with James Patterson and Casey Sherman, told the Post Saturday that Whelan's thesis was a crock. It's a fantasy, Wedge said. We went through all the case files that hadn't been looked at in 30 years. No one disputes that Chapman was the gunman. He confessed repeatedly and apologized. Whelan still can't explain exactly what happened. The motive isn't totally clear, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a CIA deep state operation, he said. There are links between fundamentalist Christians and these hypnotist doctors and Nixon as well. Nixon and Lenin were arch enemies, and Nixon was close to Ronald Reagan, who was a president-elect when the former Beatle was shot. Lenin was just coming out of his shell and getting back to political activity, and Reagan was coming into office, Whelan observed. Whelan alleges the key information surrounding the assassination was hushed up by the New York Police Department and the District Attorney's Office, and said the autopsy report was never released by the medical examiner Elliot Gross. But Wedge said he and his co-authors saw the autopsy report during their research and didn't find any major discrepancies. So you go, okay. Whelan uncovered numerous documents in the case. The Daily Mail was the first to publish Chapman's hit list, courtesy of Whelan, which included newsman Walter Cronkite, late night host Johnny Carson, actors George C. Scott, and Marlon Brando and Jackie Kennedy Onassis. Plus, it obviously sounds like it was David Bowie at one stage. So there you go, people. We have to wait for the book and the documentary to see if there's any truth in what they're saying. But he was attached to the CIA's mind control program, MK Ultra program, indirectly. And that's sort of a fact everyone's sort of been talking about from day one. My point is, these people can turn a crazy into a patsy. I don't know if Bondi Junction's got anything to do with it. Apparently, one of the victims is a 25-year-old called Dawn Singleton, daughter of the millionaire mogul John Singleton. We still don't know. First thing I thought was that it's a Palestinian gone crazy killing Jewish people in Bondi. That's the first thing I thought. But now it seems like that's not what it is. So you got to just wait till it all unfolds itself, people. But the fact is, the world is getting crazy. There's not enough police on the streets. In fact, this article that came out very recently, it says some state police forces are looking abroad for recruits as they face a shortage of trained officers. And see, that article came out today, abc.net.au. It says police forces across the country are dealing with a shortage of recruits reaching into the thousands, with Tasmania the only state not looking to boost its numbers. Nationwide, police jurisdictions are saying they are short by more than 4,000 officers, and some states are actively trying to poach officers from overseas to fill gaps. I wonder if they're Chinese police officers coming from overseas. New South Wales police is short around 1,500 officers, while Victoria and Queensland both have around 800 vacancies. South Australia wants 900 more recruits by 2026, and the Northern Territory is about 200 officers short. Now, what is really ironic, people? As soon as that lone police officer, when she took down the knife-wielding crazy, the moment she took it down, then you saw all of a sudden SWAT teams and police officers everywhere armed to the teeth. And I'm not joking. They got automatic weapons. They were all done up. It was crazy. It was like a big show of force for no particular reason, because the offender was already dead. But they marched through the streets looking like, don't even bother to think about trying to do something like that again. It's ridiculous. And then they'll disappear again, gone again. You see what I mean? It's like 17 people had already been stabbed before that police officer acted on her own. She had no accomplice, no other second officer, and had to shoot the guy dead. And that's the end of the story. We don't hear anymore because he's dead. So the door closes, and you've got to wait till they give you the official report, people. So you see how it works. It's anyway, we're going to have to wait for this one. It reminds me of the Lynch Street siege. If you remember the one in the Sydney CBD years ago, where there was a particular fellow holding up people at gunpoint, and then they said that he was an ISIS supporter, and you had all these prostitute medias all focusing in on him, and they had police snipers that could have killed him at any moment, but they didn't. They milked the story like you wouldn't believe. The police were prancing around with their automatic weapons, the same thing as what's happening now. And then I think eventually that was resolved, but this is the same thing again. It's like a different thing, because it's a knife and it's a crazy, but it's the same thing again. It's like a lone person acting to try and close the door after the incident, which it causes a nanny state, a more of a police state from that point. But it shouldn't have got to that in the first place, people. We shouldn't be living in fear like this, thinking as we bring in hundreds of thousands of people from overseas, what may or may not occur in a recession that's coming. You see, this is where you've really got to start thinking, are they doing this on purpose? Is this really just, you know, push to shove? They just want the public to start, screaming for someone to help them. You know, the Hegelian dialectic again. Yeah, there it is. There's the wiki. The Lint Cafe siege. Sorry, not street. The Lint Cafe siege was a terrorist attack. See, the first thing they said about this guy with a knife in Bondi, he's not a terrorist. That was the first thing they said. It was a terrorist attack that occurred on the 16th of December 2014 when a lone gunman, Manharan Monis, held hostage 10 customers and 8 employees of a Lint chocolate cafe in the APA building in Martin Place, Sydney, Australia. The Sydney siege led to a 16-hour standoff, after which a gunshot was heard from inside and police officers from the Tactical Operations Unit stormed the cafe. Hostage Tory Johnston was killed by Monas, and hostage Katrina Dawson was killed by a police bullet ricochet in the subsequent raid. Can you believe that, people? Monas was also killed. See, there it is. End of story. Every time it's the same people. The fact that they didn't kill Martin Bryan at the scene is very interesting, because they knew he was a nut, and they needed someone to own up to it so they could deflect any idea that there could have been someone else involved. This is the thing with all these killings, with the political ones, like the John Lennon ones, John F. Kennedy, and the Martin Bryant one, which is to get guns seized. So you think, is this a globalist plot or some sort of mandate, and they just need cause and reaction? And it just makes you wonder, people, because these things have been going on for decades and decades, but they have results. They do cause problem, reaction, solution to occur. You know, in Australia, we lost access to guns. So the people in Bondi Junction, I know this is far-fetched, but if they could have defended themselves, that would never have happened. It couldn't have happened. But you're not allowed to. So that's why 17 people got stabbed. And the police were not there until, at the end, a lone police officer that gunned the guy down. But 17 people, had already, including a baby, had already been stabbed. What do you do? How do you combat this stuff? You look back at the CCTV footage and go, well, we could have done this or that. There's no solution to this, people. When a nut is either a patsy or they're just a crazy, that's it. There's no pattern to it. You see what I mean? Because they're sort of nuts. They don't work off any sort of ideal. They're sort of like how can I put it? It's sort of like, I suppose it is sort of like a pattern where they repeat something. Like apparently the John Lennon shooter kept reading The Catcher in the Rye, the book, and he wanted to emulate it. So that was his fantasy played out in real life. But whether he actually shot Lennon now is being debated. So this is the thing. And with this particular guy with the knife, maybe the same thing was happening there. He had some sort of idea going through his head on being homeless at the time. Being an avid surfer, this guy didn't sound like he was having a bad life. This is what I'm trying to say. When you look back and look at what this guy was talking about online and this and that, you suddenly think to yourself, what was the problem? But anyway, he had problems since he was a teenager, okay? And so you see straight away that this is an ongoing thing, and the police had known him. He wasn't known for offences, but he was known for his mental condition. So who knows? Maybe in the future we're all going to have to pass mental tests to see if we're going to go off the rails and just start stabbing or shooting people. They will start to profile people. They will start to do it. And if you fall into a profile that they consider dangerous, it's possibly going to be some sort of re-education or detention centre where they take you away. It really could happen. If enough of these incidents happen, it will happen. So this is why I'm saying sometimes they don't cause it to happen, but they let it happen, knowing that it's a bit like what's happening now. I know this is completely off center, but I'm going to say it anyway. We're at the beach today, and some sort of e-bike nearly ran into us. What I'm getting at there is they're waiting for a fatality. Then they'll act on all these kids that are running around on e-bikes, flying up the footpaths with these massively heavy bikes. It could actually kill someone if they hit them, and eventually they will, whether it's the rider or someone getting hit. Someone's going to get killed, then they'll act on it. But until then, we're just going to have to keep screaming at why don't they do something about this? Because they're not. Now, on a completely different note, I don't normally talk too much about international events. I mean, of course, we've all mentioned Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, the whole thing. But what's happening now, because we're about to get hit with the world's biggest recession, they always try to divert. It's just what they do. They've always done it. Always happens. There's always a diversion to something else. In the case of Russia and Ukraine, the diversion is Israel and Gaza. We know this. But I did notice something interesting that's happening in the Israeli war that's happening, because they're starting to expand. They're starting to look at places like Syria, Lebanon, and even Iran. And what's happened, they recently bombed the embassy in Syria, where in Damascus, where they had the Iranian embassy next to the consul, and it was hit. And two of their main generals died. These are It says, Israeli strike on Iran's consulate in Syria killed two generals and five other officers, Iran says. This is very serious stuff, people. This is from apnews.com. And it came out on April the 2nd, 2024. It says, Damascus, Syria. An Israeli airstrike that demolished Iran's consulate in Syria on Monday killed two Iranian generals and five officers, including Iranian officials. The strike appeared to signify an escalation of Israel's targeting of military officials from Iran, which supports militant groups fighting Israel in Gaza and along its border with Lebanon. Since the war in Gaza began nearly 6 months ago, clashes have increased between Israel and Iran-backed Hezbollah militants based in Lebanon. Hamas, which rules Gaza and attacked Israel on October the 7th, is also backed by Iran. Israel, which rarely acknowledges strikes against Iranian targets, said it had no comment on the latest attack in Syria, although a military spokesman blamed Iran for a drone attack early Monday against a naval base in southern Israel. Israel has grown increasingly impatient with the daily exchanges of fire with Hezbollah, which have escalated in recent days, and warned of the possibility of a full-fledged war. Iranian-backed the Houthi rebels in Yemen have also been launching long-range missiles towards Israel, including on Monday. It says a member of Hezbollah, Hussein Youssef, also was killed in the attack, an official with the militant group told the Associated Press. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity in line with the group's rules. Hezbollah has not publicly announced the death. Hezbollah offered condolences to Iran for Zahedi's death and called Israel foolish when it believes that liquidating the leaders can stop the roaring tide of the people's resistance. It added in its statement that the killing will not pass without the enemy receiving punishment and revenge. And this is the smoking gun. This is the bad part. This could escalate. Remember the Prime Minister of, or the main guy, I don't even know what they call him. I think it's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. He's a guy that actually promoted Hamas back in the day because he wanted to get rid of Yasser Arafat with the People's Liberation Army. He wanted to get rid of them. No, it wasn't. It was called the PLO, People's Liberation Organization. Actually, I don't know what it stands for. One sec. I think I'm getting mixed up with China on that one. It's the Palestine Liberation Organization. So Yasser Arafat was a leader of that back in the 70s, if you remember all the terrorism. This is where it all came from initially. And so what Benjamin Netanyahu wanted to do was side with a new organization that he thought he could control, which was Hamas. So there you go, the October the 7th, all those Israeli kids died, and it's almost like it was given to them on a platter so that Benjamin Netanyahu could storm through Gaza and then go and get the gas offshore. To me, it just seems obvious. There's no other reason. Why is this happening now? What's the point? Anyway, a big recession is coming. These are the diversional tactics that they use, and this is one of them. But this could blow into a proper conflict in the Middle East, a really big one. With US backing, possibly Russian backing on the Syrian side, and even the Chinese on the Russian side with the Syrians. This is extremely dangerous, very bad for business, obviously, but a very strong possibility that we could be heading for not only the world's biggest recession, but the world's biggest war. So you can see these are big words, people. Anyway, reading on, it says here, just so you can see the powder keg that's just about to be lit. It says, two police officers who guarded the consulate were among those wounded, and first responders were still searching for bodies under the rubble. See, so Israel, well, they're not claiming they did it, but a consulate building with Iranian generals in Syria was hit and flattened, and people were killed. That's the reality. It says, while Iran's consular building was leveled in the attack, according to Syria's state news agency, its main embassy building remained intact. So it was obviously a targeted kill. Still, the Iranian ambassador's residence was inside the consular buildings. Iran's ambassador, Hussein Akbari, vowed revenge for the strike at the same magnitude and harshness. So here we go. This is an eye for an eye bit, people. Hamas and Islamic Jihad, another Palestinian militant group backed by Iran, accused Israel of seeking to widen the conflict in Gaza. Experts said there was no doubt that Iran would retaliate. The strike in Syria was a major escalation. Charles Lister, a Syria expert at the Middle East Institute in Washington, said on the social media platform X. A spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry, Nasser Kanani, called on other countries to condemn the strike. It says Israel has attacked scores of Iranian-linked targets in Syria over the years with the apparent intent of disrupting arms transfers and other cooperation with Hezbollah, which has sent thousands of fighters to support Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces. So this is gearing up to be something that could blow out into bringing in these major powers outside like the US and Russia. It says an Israeli strike in a Damascus neighborhood in December killed a longtime Iranian Revolutionary Guard advisor to Syria, Sayed Razi Mousavi. A similar strike on a building in Damascus in January killed at least five Iranian advisors. Last week, an Iranian advisor was killed in airstrikes over the eastern Syrian province of Deir el-Zor near the Iraqi border. The chief spokesman for the Israeli army, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, said on Monday, drone attack on a naval base in southern Israel was directed by Iran and caused no injuries. Early on Tuesday, the Israeli military said some kind of weapon fired from Syria towards Israel crashed before reaching its intended target. There you go. So this is the beginning of it. So let's go and see if there has been any update in this tit-for-tat across that border. Because I remember that Iran has Iraq in between it and the Middle East with Israel there. So there's a big gigantic, and Jordan as well, sort of buffer zone, you could call it. But still, this is extremely dangerous. Why? Because Israel has nuclear weapons and so does Iran. Now, this seems to be an update on what's just happened. This is today, abc.net.au. Israel shoots down most of Iran's drones, but some strike IDF targets. Iran launched a swarm of explosive drones. Remember, they make these things. They know how to do it. And fired missiles at Israel late on Saturday in its first ever direct attack on Israeli territory, risking a major escalation in the region. And that's absolutely true, people. This was meant to happen. This is what I'm saying. Tehran said it concluded its response to an attack on its consulate in Syria 2 weeks ago, and it warned the United States, which has pledged ironclad backing from Israel, not to intervene. And then it's got... So the rest of it's sort of just a recap. So it's not really a full-blown report, but it says we're close to closing the blog for tonight. This is the one on the ABC. But here's what we know so far about the Iranian strike on Israel. Israel's military says Iran has launched more than 300 drones and missiles since Saturday night, describing many as being intercepted. Remember, this is what happened in the Russia-Ukraine war. It was all drone warfare, remember? Same thing happening again. It says Iran warns against Israel retaliating, saying our response will be much larger. And it says an IDF base in southern Israel is among the infrastructure that's been damaged in the strike. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has spoken to US President Joe Biden about Iran's escalation in hostilities. Both the United Nations Security Council and the G7 leaders, globalists, are likely to meet Monday to discuss the escalating conflict, which sounds like they're orchestrating. So wait and see, people. Wait and see. Actually, I did find a report on the Drudge Report. That's on conspiracyhealth.com on the right-hand side of the widget bar. I just wanted to see, because I usually report on these sort of events pretty frequently. And it's got, Iran has launched drone attacks at Israel, US officials said. 13th of April, 2024, CNBC. Of course it is. .com. It says, and I'm just reading it for this statement that was made. Iran on Saturday launched attacks against Israel, according to US officials. escalating long-standing tensions between the two nations that have the potential to trigger a regional war. Iran has begun an airborne attack against Israel, National Security Council spokesperson Adrian Watson said in a Saturday statement. And this is the statement. The United States will stand with the people of Israel and support their defense against these threats from Iran. So there it is, people. Israeli Defense Force spokesman Daniel Hagari said Saturday that Israel would work in close coordination with the United States and regional partners to intercept the launches. It says, we are monitoring the threat in the airspace. It is a threat that takes several hours to reach the territory of the state of Israel, he added. See, when Iran fires missiles, it's got to fly over Jordan and Iraq to get to Israel. And usually Jordan is the one. And I'll show you what's happened with Jordan because I did see something. But reading on, it says, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu convened his war cabinet in Tel Aviv following the announcement of the missile and drone launches, according to the Prime Minister's office. International leaders, including European Council President Charles Michel, UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, and France's Foreign Ministry publicly condemned Iran's attack on Saturday. So you can see who the allies are. The Biden administration is expecting Iran to target Israeli government sites, not civilian or religious sites, and not U.S. assets in the area. U.S. officials told the NBC News, I must have sent them a meme saying, you can hit here, 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 and here, but not here, 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 or here. Utterly ridiculous, isn't it, people? And it goes on to say, the administration is anticipating the attack to involve 100 drones, it was 300, dozens of cruise missiles and dozens of ballistic missiles, one of the officials added. Ahead of the attacks on Saturday, President Joe Biden was en route back to the White House earlier than initially scheduled to meet with his national security team, including Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, amid the growing prospect of an Iranian strike. Now, there's something else amongst this. Just on that statement alone, where Biden's off to meet his team, with a new election coming, people, what do you think the American people will do if an actual regional war starts up there that the US are then involved with, like properly? Do you think they'll keep Biden and continue as they are, or they will vote for Trump? What do you think the public will do? Because this is also fueling that fire. It's a big deal. It's not like they were just sitting back and it's a boxing ring between Biden and Trump. No, no. When you throw in the probability of the US dragged into a regional war, it sort of keeps the status quo as it is. This has happened before in the past. You've had war prime ministers like Winston Churchill in the UK. As soon as the war was over, he wasn't needed. So there are certain people that can still hold the reins in a conflict. And I think the American people, and if they do trigger this war, I think the American people will keep Biden in simply because it's stability. Even though he can't stand on two feet, the fact is Trump would be a wild card in a situation like that. So this is also a probability that they are stoking the fire to make this happen so that Trump can't get back in. These are really big probabilities, people, because remember, Trump, he's not pro-Russian, but he doesn't want to force Putin's hand. He would let that roll out. He would not support it. In a million years, I don't think Trump would support Ukraine against Russia. He would let them fight it out. That's what would happen. The same thing in Israel. He would let them fight it out with their neighbors. He would not back them. Because he knows that what Trump says all the time is he can stop all these wars. Oh, I'll just stop them. But basically, in these cases, the wars have already started, you see. So he's talking about the wars never starting if he was in power, but he's not in power and the wars have started. And it looks like this war is going to escalate even bigger. And remember, gas is the target, people. The gas in Gaza is the target because it's trillions of cubic feet of gas worth billions upon billions and billions of dollars for whoever wants to take it. And Israel started doing their... what they call not digging, it's where they actually look in the area to see if it's a possibility to get the stuff. I forget what they call it, but you know what I'm saying. But that was actually stopped in the courts for 10 years as they fought with the Palestinians on who had control of it. So they finally decided to just go and do it. They didn't care about the Palestinians. They just said, we're going to go and do it. So they're exploratory. That's what it was, exploratory drilling, looking for this gas. And they want it. And there's all these countries in the area that want it as well, like Syria and all these other ones. And this is why this war is happening. People go, oh, no, it's religious. Now, there's lots of side reasons, but the main one is the gas. I'm telling you, they're going to start drilling for that this year, the moment they get access. And they've already got access. So now if they can push the Palestinians out of Gaza, they don't have to worry about it. They'll just go and get the gas. Now, on a completely different note, I wanted to talk about this issue. This is an extremely important one to Australia because it's about nuclear energy. They're now saying that renewables are the go, but they know, and I know they know, that renewables will fail. And so waiting in the wings is the possibility that Australia could go nuclear. There's a lot of people that actually agree with it now. They just think, oh, well, let's just do that, because they just want the power to stay switched on, especially after headlines like this. abc.net.au, your power bills are going up according to one energy boss. Here's why. 12th of April, 2024. It says, you came here for truth and straight talk, so here's a doozy. Standing on stage at the National Press Club, being beamed live into offices and lounge rooms across the country, one of Australia's top energy bosses was preparing to say what few in the industry will acknowledge publicly. Jeff Dimery, CEO of Alinta Energy, looked up from his notes on the lectern and delivered the promised doozy to the audience. Australians will have to pay more for energy in the future, he says. We need to be honest about that. So it says, honesty and transparency are features that have been arguably missing from an often ideologically driven and contorted debate about energy policy in this country. And it's got clean energy half-truth. Australia's in the midst of a complex and challenging clean energy transition that is so large in scale it's been likened to the biggest peacetime challenge the country's faced. Because they're just closing all the power stations down, people. We're going to be in a real pickle really, really soon. It says by 2050, coal, the backbone of the power grid that's producing 60% of our electricity today, is set to be phased out altogether and replaced by renewables. Don't ever forget too, people, there are countries across the other side of the world like India and China that buy our coal, and they are more polluting to like combine the two of them with the biggest populations on the planet than the whole world combined. They are the biggest polluters, and they are building more power, coal-fired power stations, and yet we're closing the last 20 or 25 of ours down, and we'll end up with none. And so it says 2050 coal. No, it's going to go a lot sooner than that. It says the federal government has set ambitious targets to achieve that goal. Within 6 years, it wants 82% of Australia's power to come from sources like wind, solar, and hydro, up from 32% now, requiring a tripling of clean energy generation by 2030. Absolutely impossible. They know this is going to fail. That's why they want the public to panic, and then they offer them the yellow cake. It says, few would question the necessity of this transition. Oh, here we go. As climate records continue to tumble for all the wrong reasons. Really? But Australians have been promised the cleaner energy would equal cheaper energy. And yet power bills have only risen since Russia's invasion of Ukraine triggered a global price shock. No, Ukraine had nothing to do with Australia. They keep saying it. It's a bit like when they say our petrol is a problem. That's to do with Singapore. You see, that it's all indirect, but they like to make it look like it's everybody's problem. So it says prices have, and just to give you an example, a few days ago, the petrol Bowser had $1.82 a litre for petrol. Today, it was on $2.36, I think. It was ridiculous. And it's up and down like a yo-yo, whatever they feel like doing. There's no sort of pattern to it anymore. And now the cat's out of the bag and you sort of realise, hang on, are we getting fleeced by the oil company? Well, yes, because that's going to want you to make an electric car, isn't it? Anyway, I did see a guy in an electric car the other day. We had a massive torrential downpour here on the northern beaches. And there's, I remember seeing recently a poor guy trying to get out of his car to plug his electric car into one of these charging stations in the pouring rain, because they're not undercover. And of course, he's in his Tesla and he plugs it in and jumps back in the car. And I remember probably about 45, probably 50 minutes later, he's still sitting in the car. And then I see him get out of the car just by chance and plug it back in to the thing and then drive off. I just thought it was hilarious because they're not really catered for, because it's really just a, what would they call it? Sort of not an example. It's more of a token energy sort of solution. That's really what they're doing when you see those cars everywhere, because you all see them. And I do see the Chinese electric car ads now popping up on telly, so get ready for the what's it called, the GWM, the Great Wall Motors, and the BYD Beijing something something coming, people, they're coming. And to continue with the ABC story, it says, prices have thankfully stabilised, but on a broader point, Demery says Australians have been fed up with what he calls a half-truth. Yes, renewables are the lowest cost new form of generation, but building the wind and solar farms at the scale required to replace coal, together with the batteries needed to store the power and the new network of transmission lines to distribute that power to consumers, will involve tens of billions of dollars worth of investment. The Australian energy market operator's own figures suggest the transition will cost around $383 billion between now and 2050. When asked who pays, Demery replied, "It all comes from consumers, whether through the bill directly or through the tax base." And this is not an argument against the transition, Demery says. Replacing coal with coal would cost even more. Alinta Energy is a retailer and a generator which has a foot in both the old and new. It owns the Loy Yang B coal fire power station in Victoria and is investing heavily in wind farms and batteries. Demery used his speech to call for an honest conversation about the energy transition, saying Australians right now were not prepared for the reality of paying more. So it's got transmission cost to drive power bill increase. To understand why, Demery explained how a power bill is calculated. Oh, here we go, people. Wholesale energy prices, the cost of generating electricity from coal, gas, wind or solar, make up about 32% of the power bill. And after 2 years of steep increases, households should expect some relief this year. It says network costs, the poles and the wires, account for about 45% of a power bill. And it's these costs that are on the way up. That's because another 10,000 kilometres of high voltage transmission lines are being built across the country between now and 2050 as part of the federal government's $20 billion Rewiring the Nation plan. I wonder if that's got to do with 5G. Anybody out there is relying purely on the grid for their energy will end up paying more, Demery says. Renewable energy has zero fuel costs, so once the infrastructure has been built, in theory, I like that part, power prices should moderate. It's just not clear when. Until then, apart from using taxpayers' money to subsidise power bills for vulnerable Australians and encouraging voters to invest in solar panels, batteries, EVs and more efficient appliances, the government is somewhat constrained. See, all of those things are online. The batteries, the EVs, energy efficient appliances, all hooked into the internet, all hooked into the 5G network. This is what they want. It says this is politically problematic when affordability has become the top concern for Australians. Well, a recent CSIRO survey of 6,700 people found a majority of respondents want a moderately placed transition towards renewables but are unwilling to accept higher bills to pay for it. Oh boy. A Redbridge poll of 2,000 people, because that's what polls usually are, people, 1,000, 2,000 people, published in the Australian Financial Review, found most respondents prioritise lowering their power bills over fast emissions reduction. After a decade of internecine wars over carbon taxes, emissions trading schemes and national energy guarantees, Both major parties have now committed to achieving net zero emissions by the middle of the century. What's up for debate now is the pathway. Here we go, people. Most of Australia's coal-fired power stations are on track to retire within the next 15 years, and on any given day, they're producing around 60% of Australia's electricity. So they're going to close them all down and have nothing to back it up. That's what's coming. Wind and solar farms are not being built fast enough to replace that capacity, and there are signs some states, unions, and heavy industry are growing nervous about keeping the lights on. Funny that, people. Victoria last year signed an undisclosed deal to avoid an unplanned closure of the state's Yallourn and Loy Yang A coal-fired power stations, and New South Wales is in talks with the operator of Earing about extending its life beyond its stated 2025 closure, which is next year. This is ridiculous. We're going to have no power, people. You understand? So it says, against this backdrop, and amid growing concerns in regional areas about the massive expansion of renewable and transmission projects, the coalition is going nuclear. There it is, people, right in your face. Concerns in regional Australia drive nuclear push. Peter Dutton, who also looks a bit like Voldemort, is putting the finishing touches on his party's plan. Because I call them the Liberal Party. I don't like either of the parties. I think they're both completely compromised by the New World Order. But it says Peter Dutton is finally, he's putting finishing touches on his party's plan, but has previously pushed small modular reactors, an evolving technology that's yet to be developed or commercially proven in the West, and large-scale nuclear reactors on the site of retiring coal-fired power stations. Geez, that's almost as funny as putting the EV charging stations in the petrol stations. It's the same thing, isn't it, people? Bit of a furphy where you think, oh, it's going to be all right, we'll just put that there. When in actual reality, they haven't done that. They're just saying it. And it says here, on the face of it, it could present as an appealing alternative for voters in regional Australia who don't want transmission lines through their properties and wind and solar farms industrialising their communities. It goes on to say that nuclear power plants have a smaller footprint, oh yes, and in theory wouldn't require a whole new network of poles and wires to be built. Here we go, people. But at the heart of the policy will be the promise to all voters that nuclear energy will deliver reliable, clean and cheaper power. What do you think is going to happen, people, when we all see renewables will fail? What do you think the Hegelian dialectic for energy is all about? So it says, and why Bill Gates was here months ago hawking his own TerraPower. What a great name. More than 30 countries, including the United States and United Kingdom, are using nuclear power to help decarbonize their grids. It supplies about 10% of the world's electricity. There you go. They want us all to go into this dangerous era. That share could increase given dozens of countries sign a pledge at last year's COP28 conference in Dubai to triple the world's nuclear generation capacity by 2050. And believe me, people, when that happens, where do you think they want to dump the waste? We're getting to that. So it says here, reading on, but if Dutton is trying to convince Australians to back his plan on the basis of affordability, he's asking voters to take a big bet on the future. According to the International Atomic Energy Agency, it would take at least 10 to 15 years to develop a nuclear reactor from scratch and upfront capital costs, according to the CSIRO, would be far higher than wind and solar farms. That's because you overcome obstacles including the fear factor, driven by high-profile disasters on Fukushima and Chernobyl, the decades-old debate over where to safely store nuclear waste in Australia, and the fact that the technology is currently banned by both federal and state laws. That's changing. The next section is called Unicorns in the Garden. I thought this was funny. Sentiments appear to be shifting, though. Oh, yeah. With polling suggesting about half of Australians back the idea of nuclear energy. See, they asked 1,000 people that, people. Support is the highest among younger Australians. Well, there you go, with no idea. They probably haven't seen Oppenheimer, Chernobyl, or even Fukushima, anything on it yet. As nuclear engineer Edward Obard from the University of New South Wales puts it, the greatest threat to their future is climate change. And they're willing to consider all solutions to that. Oh, there you go. There it is. The old climate hoax is forcing it. Energy experts like the Grattan Institute's Tony Wood and former chief scientist Alan Finkel reckon we shouldn't rule out nuclear as a plan B. These guys are also globalist people, the Grattan Institute, just thought I'd throw that in there. Shouldn't rule out plan B in the future if technology continues to evolve and the economics stack up. But until it's even legal in Australia, energy bosses like Jim Dimery liken the pursuit of nuclear to looking for unicorns in the garden. Whichever path Australia takes, at the bottom of the garden, we'll all have to pay. And that's the doozy. So let's go and see if there's a proposal to dump this nuclear waste in Australia. And I'm not even talking about the nuclear reactors being built here in Australia yet. I'm just talking about other countries building more of them there, like in Europe, and they want to dump more of it here in Australia. Now, I just want to read this to people because this is to do with the nuclear phase out. This is where people don't want nuclear anymore. So we're talking about all these countries in Australia and everyone looking at it and going, oh, this could be the way out of our energy problems because we're getting rid of coal. And this is a Wikipedia based on nuclear power phase out. So I thought it was worth just looking at it quickly. And it says here, a nuclear power phase out is the discontinuation of usage of nuclear power for energy production. Often initiated because of concerns about nuclear power phase outs usually include shutting down nuclear power plants and looking towards fossil fuels and renewable energy. Three nuclear accidents have influenced the discontinuation of nuclear power. The 1979 Three Mile Island partial nuclear meltdown in the United States, the 1986 Chernobyl disaster in the USSR, now Ukraine, and the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan. As of 2023, only two countries have permanently closed all of their formerly functioning nuclear plants. Italy by 1990 and Germany by 2023. Lithuania and Kazakhstan have shut down their only nuclear plants but plan to build new ones to replace them, while Armenia shut down its only nuclear plant but subsequently restarted it. Austria never used its first nuclear plant that was completely built. Cuba, Libya, North Korea and Poland never completed the construction of their first nuclear plants due to financial, political and technical reasons. Spain and Switzerland plan nuclear phase-outs. So it says nuclear shutdowns after Fukushima has significantly set back emissions reduction goals because they all thought that's how they would get their people in several countries. A recent study of the impacts of the German and Japan closures conclude that by continuing to operate their nuclear plants, these two countries could have prevented 28,000 air pollution-induced deaths and 2,400 MTCO2 emissions between 2011 and 2017. See, they're blaming them for stopping nuclear. By sharply reducing nuclear instead of coal and gas after Fukushima, both countries lost the chance to prevent any very large amounts of air pollution-induced deaths and CO2 emissions. I tell you what, if one of these plants go off, there'll be more than just a few people, 28,000 air pollution-induced deaths, I can tell you. Go and watch Oppenheimer and get an idea of what happened 80 years ago. That's how long it was. Several countries formally opposed to opening nuclear programs or planning phase-outs that have reversed the course in recent years due to climate concerns and energy independence, including Belgium, the Philippines, Greece, Sweden, and South Korea. And it says, a popular movement against nuclear power exists in the Western world based on concerns about more nuclear accidents, which is what I'm worried about, and concerns about nuclear waste. Let's go and have a look at that then, people. We don't want to dwell on the let's stop it because they don't want to stop it. They want to bring this sort of stuff in and they need somewhere to dump nuclear. the waste. So I'm just going to go straight to this nuclear waste and see who actually stores it all around the world, and is Australia one of them? Okay, so this just says radioactive waste. Again, it's another Wikipedia, thanks Jimmy Wales. But what I want to see is countries where who's getting the dumping. That's what I'm trying to find. So we'll start off with this section here, which is called legacy waste. Very interesting, people. Due to historic activities typically related to the radium industry, uranium mining, and military programs, numerous sites contain or are contaminated with radioactivity. In the United States alone, the Department of Energy states that there are millions of gallons of radioactive waste, as well as thousands of tons of spent nuclear fuel and material, and also huge quantities of contaminated soil and water. Despite copious quantities of waste, the DOE has stated a goal of cleaning all presently contaminated sites successfully by 2025. So, still not done, people. It says the Fernaid, Ohio site, for example, has 31 million pounds of uranium product, 2.5 billion pounds of waste, and it says 2.75 million cubic yards of contaminated soil and debris. And a 223-acre portion of the underlying Great Miami Aquifer had uranium levels above drinking standards. Can you believe that, people? Oh, I can. The United States has at least 108 sites designated as areas that are contaminated and unusable. Sometimes many thousands of acres. This is just lands destroyed forever. The DOE wishes to clean or mitigate many of it all by 2025. Good luck. It's not far off now, people. 6 months away and they've got to have it done. I bet they don't. Using the recently developed method of geo-melting. However, the task can be difficult and it acknowledges that some may never be completely remediated. In just one of these 108 larger designations, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, there were, for example, at least 167 known contaminant release sites in one of the three subdivisions of the 37-acre, which is 150 square kilometres site. Some of the US sites were smaller in nature. However, cleanup issues were simpler to address. And it says the DOE has successfully completed cleanup or at least closure of several sites. I mean, and then it's got low-level waste. And it says low-level waste is generated from hospitals and industry as well as nuclear fuel cycle. Low-level waste include paper, rags, tools, clothing, filters, and other materials which contain small amounts of mostly short-lived radioactivity. Materials that originate from any region of an active area are commonly designated as low-level waste. So now you know what that is. It says intermediate-level waste. Intermediate-level waste contains higher amounts of radioactivity compared to low-level waste. It generally requires shielding, but not cooling. Immediate level wastes include resins, chemical sludge, and nuclear fuel cladding, as well as contaminated materials from a reactor decommissioning. It may be solidified in concrete or bitumen, because I've known about this, or mixed with silica sand and vitrified for disposal. As a general rule, short-lived waste, mainly non-fuel materials from reactors, is buried, in shallow repositories, while long-lived waste from fuel and fuel processing is deposited in geological repository. So there you go. And then it's got high-level waste. Now, this is what I don't want to come to Australia, okay? High-level waste is produced by nuclear reactors and the reprocessing of nuclear fuel. The exact definition of high-level waste differs internationally. After a nuclear fuel rod serves one fuel cycle and is removed from the core, it is considered high-level waste. Spent fuel rods contain mostly uranium with fission products and transuranic, looks like ceramic, yes, elements generated in the reactor core. Spent fuel is highly radioactive and often hot. High-level waste accounts for over 95% of the total radioactivity produced in the process of nuclear electricity. You understand that, people? 95% of total radioactivity produced in the process of nuclear electricity. So this is what Dutton wants, and probably Bill Gates and the rest of them. It says, but it contributes to less than 1% of the volume of all radioactive waste produced in the UK. Overall, the 60-year-long nuclear program in the UK up until 2019 produced 2,150 square metres of high-level waste, which is quite a lot. The radioactive waste from spent fuel rods consists primarily of, CESIUM, cesium, and strontium-90. That's what they spray in the skies on us. And it may also include plutonium, which can be considered transuranic waste. The half-lives of these radioactive elements can differ quite extremely. It says some elements such as cesium-137 and strontium-90 have half-lives, wait for people, of approximately 30 years. So that's okay, that's a short life. Meanwhile, plutonium has a half-life that can stretch as long as 24,000 years. Oh, just when I thought we were getting there. The amount of high-level waste worldwide is currently increasing, here we go people, by about 12,000 tonnes every year. And it says a 1,000 megawatt nuclear power plant produces about 27T of spent nuclear fuel unprocessed every year. For comparison, the amount of ash produced by coal power plants in the United States alone is estimated at 130 million T per year. So they're saying it's very low. But the fact is, that's 1,000 watt. Megawatt nuclear power plant. Coal-fired power stations can produce 1,500 and higher megawatts. So let's read on and see. They're trying to give you the comparison here. In 2010, it is estimated that about 250,000 tons, that must be the T people, it doesn't say tons, but I'm assuming the T is tons, of nuclear high-level waste were stored globally. This does not include amounts that have escaped into the environment from accidents or tests. Japan is estimated to hold 17,000, that must be tons, of high-level waste in storage in 2015. As of 2019, the United States has over 90,000 tons of high-level waste, and it says high-level waste has been shipped to other countries to be stored or reprocessed, and in some cases, shipped back as active fuel. So let's see if we can find if Australia is going to become a target for this nuclear waste, in particular, this high-level waste. That's what we really want to know about, people. We don't want to know about anything else because even if they don't build the reactors here, they plan on dumping that stuff in Australia. And that's what I do know. So I'm just going to go and see if there's been any updates on international waste coming to Australia. One sec. Now, actually, I found tons of articles going back quite a few years about them wanting to bring nuclear waste to Australia. Now, at the moment, we've only got low-level waste, which is what I mentioned before of the type of levels. But there's also stories like this one about intermediate waste coming to Australia. This is back in, if I can get the date, October 21st of October 2021. And this is from theguardian.com. It says, Australia to receive UK nuclear waste shipment amid bitter dispute over national storage facility. And it's got 2 tonnes of nuclear waste will be shipped from the United Kingdom to Australia next year. This is back then. As debate continues over a national storage facility. The shipment of 4 500-kilogram canisters inside a forged steel container called a TN81 is part of a waste swap deal with the UK. The intermediate level waste, so the next level up, people, is to be stored temporarily at Sydney's Lucas Heights facility, then sent to the National Radioactive Waste Management Facility the federal government plans to build near Kimba in South Australia. They've already got the waste and haven't even built the facility. However, the project is the subject of a bitter dispute and is years away. It will take several years for all the regulatory approvals to pass, and the government has declined to nominate when it will start construction. So they've asked for the waste, which is stored in Sydney now, and they haven't even got anywhere to take it. In 1996, Australia spent fuel rods from its HIFAR reactor, the predecessor of the existing Opal multi-purpose reactor, to the UK to be recycled into fuel for nuclear power plants. The radiological equivalent waste will be sent to Australia under the 2022 Waste Repatriation Project. Oh, here it comes. It's got the Australian Radiation Protection and Nuclear Safety Agency, APANSA, reported this week that it is working with the UK's Office for Nuclear Regulation for the inspection of radioactive waste containers set to return to Australia from the Sellafield reprocessing plant. So you can see intermediate waste. That's a key word in that article. I don't want to read any more about it, but you can see they need somewhere to dump this now. So they've already accepted nuclear waste higher than what we normally store, and they don't even know where they're going to put it. That's how smart we are here. Ridiculous. And this story ties in completely with the problem of what's happened recently with the nuclear submarine debate. Remember all that? We're watching all these Collins-class submarines out the door and they've got the new ones coming and we're thinking, well, what's this hoo-ha all about? This is what could be a backdoor for nuclear waste in Australia. Okay, this is from theguardian.com again. Came out on the 2nd of April 2024. Poison portal. The US and the UK could send nuclear waste to Australia under AUKUS. That's the AUKUS deal, inquiry told. It says, it says, Australia could become a poison portal for international radioactive waste under the AUKUS deal. A parliamentary inquiry into nuclear safety legislation has heard. New laws to establish a safety framework for Australia's planned nuclear-powered submarines could also allow the US and the UK to send waste here, while both of these countries are struggling to deal with their own waste as no long-term high-level waste facilities have been created. The government introduced the Australian Naval Nuclear Power Safety Bill in November last year. If passed, it will establish a nuclear safety watchdog, allow for naval nuclear propulsion facilities to be created, including for storing or disposing of radioactive waste from the AUKUS submarines. A second bill to enable the regulator to issue licenses was introduced at the same time. Unbelievable, people. Both have been referred to a Senate inquiry, which was due to report on the 26th of April. So, round Anzac Day, we're going to know if we're going to get stuff dumped here. Dave Sweeney, the Australian Conservation Foundation's nuclear free campaigner, said the issue of waste disposal was highly disturbing and that the AUKUS partners could see Australia as a little bit of a radioactive terra nullius, especially when it viewed in context to the contested and still unresolved issue of domestic intermediate level waste management, the clear failure of our AUKUS partners to manage their own naval waste, the potential for this bill to be a poison portal to international waste, and the failure of defence to effectively address existing waste streams, most notably, oh, I love this bit, people, the PFAS, he said. PFAS, I've got to click the link. I want to see what they go to. It's a big deal. This is going to pop up everywhere. It's in the water supply. It says, Australian government reaches a $132 million class action settlement with landowners over the PFAS contamination. So we've already talked about that. We know that. That was back in May 2023. But that's another smoking gun coming, people, with poison in not just the PFAS, but also the nuclear waste that's destined for our pristine shores no more. And reading on, it says, the Defence Minister Richard Marles has previously accused the Greens of fear-mongering when they raised similar concerns, saying the government would not accept waste from other nations. And it says, however, the legislation allows for the creation of facilities for managing, storing, or disposing of radioactive waste from an AUKUS submarine. Now, AUKUS is Australia, UK, and US. So we could be potentially being a dumping ground, as they're saying in the article, for the US and UK submarines. And it defines an AUKUS submarine as either an Australian, there you go, or UK, US submarine. Now, in their defence, the government has been clear it will not accept high-level nuclear waste and spent nuclear fuel from other countries as part of Australia's acquisition of nuclear-powered submarine capability. So we'll see. We'll hold them to that, people. So we're on a thin edge sword at the moment, waiting to see if they're going to be bought out. But the bottom line is they are all eyes are on Australia to dump the waste here. We just want to make sure it's not the high-level waste. The low-level waste, yes, is happening, and obviously that last article I read about the UK and intermediate waste, but you do not want the high-level waste, people. So this is the argument about whether we should have nuclear reactors or not. And there's a few articles here to support the not. One sec. So this particular article, theguardian.com, it says nuclear power too expensive and slow to be part of Australia's plans to reach net zero, study finds. And it says here, this came on the 12th of July, 2023. It says that nuclear power should not form part of Australia's plans to reach net zero emissions because it is too expensive and slow, according to the final report of a project that models how Australia might meet its 2050 climate target. The Net Zero Australia Report, a partnership between the major academic institutions and the management consultancy Noyce Group, said the federal government has a major role to play in accelerating all options that could make a material contribution to achieving net zero. It says the release of the report comes days after the opposition leader Peter Dutton ramped up calls for nuclear power in Australia and a debate about removing the legislative ban on nuclear power in Australia. The report includes major investment in batteries, solar, onshore wind, pumped hydro and transmission. Among renewable options, offshore wind was found to have the most uncertain pipeline, with the report concluding first power from offshore wind projects needed to occur in 2030. But the report concludes nuclear power should not be factored in net zero plans and states that to reduce renewable targets in the belief that nuclear will be deployed later at scale would create a material risk of not achieving net zero or doing so at an excessive cost. Says Richard Bolt, principal at the Noyce Group, said, nuclear power should not be in our plans because it's too expensive and slow. Only a dramatic fall in costs and prolonged renewable constraints would prompt a rethink. So that's one article saying, don't do it, right? That's more than over a year ago where they're saying it's not a good idea to do this. We should think of something else. And then you move on to another one. It says, here's why there is a no nuclear option for Australia to reach net zero. And this has came out in theguardian.com again. Seems I've grabbed all the Guardian ones. 22nd of March 2024, so more up to date. It says the battle lines have been drawn over Australia's energy future. With the nation signed up to net zero emissions by 2050, the Albanese Labor government is committed to renewables. The coalition wants nuclear. So you can see this is getting a political thing about it, people. The opposition leader Peter Dutton has a vision for meeting Australia's energy needs that would include large-scale nuclear power plants and small modular reactors, a technology that is not yet proven, but which the Shadow Minister for Energy, Ted O'Brien, says could be up and running within a 10-year period. They all say that. While nuclear power might experience a resurgence globally and eventually have a role in Australia, it would probably be the waste, right now, no matter how much intent there might be to activate a nuclear power industry, it is difficult to envision before 2040. Well, they want it, all right. The reality is there is no substitute for solar and wind power this decade and next, supported by batteries, transmission lines and peaking gas generation. There it is. Any call to go directly from coal to nuclear is effectively a call to delay decarbonisation of our electricity system by 20 years, really. So it's got the pros. From a purely engineering perspective, there is no better choice of zero emissions electricity than nuclear power. There you go, people. Let's see what the cons are. I'm going, the cons. There are challenges for nuclear power in Australia, most notably timetable and cost. So this is it. But it is a political thing, people. And they've got the cost of wind versus nuclear. Coal-fired generators and nuclear power generators can dispatch electricity at full power more than 90% of the year. That is true. In practice, because demand fluctuates. The typical dispatch level from an Australian coal-fired fleet is about 60%. For comparison, what would be the capital cost of a wind farm to dispatch 60% of the year? A simplified approach would be to ignore market economics and variability of solar electricity in the system and assume a 30% capacity factor for wind energy. With these assumptions, for a wind farm to dispatch 60% of the year, we would need to install 2 gigawatts of wind turbines. Says the first gigawatt of turbines would be dispatched when the wind is blowing, and the second gigawatts of the turbines will be used to charge a 7 gigawatt hour battery to be discharged into the grid on demand. That's massive. A gigawatt. Remember, we were talking 1200 megawatts or 1500 megawatts for a coal-fired power station. They want a gigawatt for a, that's ridiculous. It's just on paper, people. It says, using figures from the CSIRO's Gen Cost Graph 2023 to 24 report, the cost in the simplified model would be around $7 billion per gigawatt. That's per gigawatt. Other less costly and integration configurations are available. In comparison, based on the latest cost estimates for the Hinkley Point C plant under construction in the UK, the cost for nuclear power would be $27 billion per gigawatt. So they want you to go windy, turbiney thingy. All right, people? That's what that's about. And to finish that report off, it's pretty funny how they're going through it. So it's too costly, but it says, still, introducing nuclear power when we can, starting in the 2040s, would bring benefits. Most importantly, nuclear power generation would reduce the ongoing mining footprint. Funny that. For the regular replacement of solar panels, wind turbines, and batteries. And the expanded electricity generation to support decarbonising our exports and population growth. That's there you go, people. So they do want to do this in the long run. It's just that right now they're saying, no, let's not let Peter Dutton win. It's political. And on a completely different note, I'll end today's podcast on a good thing. This is a story from activistpost.com, a very good site for independent journalists. It's called Do the Right Thing. Assange supporters urge as Biden mulls dropping the case. April 13, 2024. President Joe Biden this week for the first time said his administration is weighing the Australian government's request to drop charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who has been deprived of his freedom since 2010, as in currently jailed in London's notorious Belmarsh prison while fighting extradition to the United States. It says, asked by reporters at the White House about requests from the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and members of the country's parliament for the US and United Kingdom to drop the extradition effort and charges against Assange, an Australian citizen, Biden said that we're considering it. Let's just hope and pray that Biden, in his final years of dementia, does the right thing, eh, people? Let's leave it at that. Okay, people, this is the Conspiracy Off podcast for Sunday, the 14th of April, 2024. Thanks for listening. Over and out.